I'd like to call this meeting of the House State Affairs Committee to order. The time is 3:16 on Thursday, March 26th. We're here in room 120, and please remember to silence cell phones. Members present today include Representative St. Clair, Representative Vance, Representative Himshute, and myself, Chair Carrick. And let the record reflect we have a quorum to conduct business. Our record secretary is Andy Magnuson, and our moderator from the Juno LI is Renzo Moises. Our committee aide for today's meeting is my staff, Stuart Relay. Today's House State Affairs hearing is a series of presentations broadly covering broadband in Alaska. Today we will have about 20 minutes total per presenter, and we'll go in order with the Alaska Broadband Office, then GCI, then Alaska Communications, Tanana Chiefs Conference, and Pacific Dataport. And we will have to hold each group to approximately that amount of time, including questions. So if there are questions that are broader in scope that can't be answered at this hearing, then we'll just ask the presenter as we go to please follow up with us. I just wanted to start with a opening statement today that Alaska, being a vast rural state without widespread internet access, makes it imperative that on occasion we bring together internet providers and policymakers to discuss where broadband coverage is at in Alaska. And in February, it was announced that the state will receive over $600 million through the BEAD program, or Broadband Equity Access and Deployment Program, which was established through the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act in 2021. So as we start today, we're going to hear from the Broadband Office, which was created by this body in 2022 with the passage of HB 363. To administer broadband funds from the federal government. And then after that, as I mentioned, we have testimony from several internet providers and stakeholders. And I apologize in advance if members are not able to ask all of the questions that they might like to of each presenter, but we want to give each of our presenters time today to speak. So I want to thank first Tom Lochner from the Alaska, Director of the Alaska Broadband Office. If you'd like to go ahead and kick us off by putting yourself on the record and start the presentation. And I'll also just note that Representative Holland has also joined us.
Thank you, Chair. I'm Thomas Lochner. I'm the Director of the Alaska Broadband Office. And my presentation, I think, will be about 10 minutes. So you should have plenty of time for questions, and I might be able to donate some time to the other presenters. So I wanted to launch right in. The background you covered, that this the Broadband Office was created as a function of House Bill 363. Currently, there are five employees: myself, a deputy director, project coordinator, permit facilitator, and a executive assistant. And we also have support. We are matrixed into the Division of Community and Regional Affairs, as well as the Department of Admin, and they have provided tremendous support through folks that they've expertise that they've loaned or that we've negotiated with them. We also, now that, and I can happily announce that we received our notice of award from the National Institute of Standards and Technology. While we were awarded the awards by the National Telecommunications and Information Administration on February 24th, the actual subgrantee or the agreement would come from NIST. And so we received that on Tuesday. And so we now are working with partners in the Department of Transportation, Department of Environmental Conservation, Department of Natural Resources, and other departments to get the permitting streamlined so that this infrastructure can be built as quickly as possible. I wanted to quickly go through the last couple years through the benchmarks. For time, I won't read all. Oops, I'm sorry, Stuart. I have control of this.
Yes.
Oh, sorry. All right. Yes, we're on the next one. Sorry.
You can push the up arrow or space bar will do it.
Okay. Gotcha. In the summer of 2023, June 30th or June 1st, we were allocated just over $1 billion for the broadband project. That then triggered what was called the initial proposal, and it was, dear state of Alaska, please propose a grant program and a series of broadband serviceable locations, or BSLs, that you want to hit with that grant program. The short version of the broadband serviceable locations was called the Mapping Challenge, or Initial Proposal Volume 1, and the actual broadband grant program was called Initial Proposal Volume 2. Those ran in parallel through the summer, spring and summer of 2024. We submitted both of those as, here's how we want to prosecute those to the NTIA. They came back with cures, and through that back and forth, then we landed on, in the fall of 2024, in the early winter of 2024, approval of both of those, the Mapping Challenge Initial Proposal Part 1 and the Broadband Grant Program Initial Proposal Volume 2. We then put the grant out to the public for a 90-day application period on December 16th of 2024. We found out pretty early in 2025 that there was going to be significant changes to the program by the new administration. So we made the decision in March to say, okay, rather than continue having folks develop their program to have it radically changed potentially, we put a pause on it in March, and then we got notification in June that the program was significantly restructured by the NTIA through the Secretary of Commerce. Other states have said to the NTIA, please don't wreck our summer this year with non-deployment funds, which I'll talk about in a little bit, but it definitely, they gave us 90 days to rerun the program and get it completely done. So we were very busy through the summer of 2025. We were able to then complete the evaluations and submit our initial package of provisional grant awards in October of 2025. And the NTIA then came back to us and said, guys, some of these we need more justification on, which we did in November. And then the quite extensive justification. They then came back, the NTIA came back in early January and said, we just can't accept these top seven projects on a per location basis. They exceeded $50,000 per location to build. And so as I said, go back and run a best and final offer with all of the, not only the folks who submitted and were awarded, but also anybody who applied for those. So there were 10 total in that round. We were able to get all but three below that 50,000 mark. We were then pressed to go back and try again to get them below the 50,000 per location mark, which we ultimately did. And so then we submitted that and then got on the 13th of February this year, and then got our approval on the 24th of February. So we're very excited. Now that we have approval from the NTIA and have approval from the National Institute of Standards and Technology, or NIST. I wanted to go through that. They have approved NTIA grants of $629,172,952 and I think 83 cents, or $51.83, this rounds up. So we've broken it down. Originally, when we first started, we had a planning grant of $5 million to get the program started. That led us to develop a five-year action plan, which we posted in 2023, develop those two programs that I talked about, the initial proposal, volume one and volume two, and run through. And we're still using some of that planning grant funding because we're not quite into full development funds yet. The remainder you can see is a $1.12 billion. Of that, the state can use up to 2%. For administration. We will use that funding not only for the broadband office, but as I mentioned, we will have partners in the other departments, and we have capacity to potentially bring additional capacity for the permitting in those other departments. We have $362 million of what's called non-deployment funds. Those are funds that we haven't received policy guidance from the NTIA on. We were hoping to have those two Thursdays ago, but they are still working through those, what that policy guidance is on that. And so I would like to say how we can spend that $362 million, but we just don't have the policy guidance from the NTIA yet. But for the grants that we did award, they break down into 15 sub-grantees over 29 grants. Over the next two pages here, you can see what they are. And then what happens next? When we got our NIST approval on Tuesday, it started a parallel track. One track is the state's evaluation of the agreement, and it's already with law to do their evaluation. And we have 30 days to respond and sign that. It also triggered a potentially six-month negotiation with the subgrantees to get their subgrantee agreements in place. Some of them will go very quickly. Some of them will take much longer. If someone is, for example, there's a tribal consent component to the negotiations. If they don't have that tribal consent yet, they have time to gain it. If there is no tribal consent necessary, they can move through the contract process relatively easily. We did a look at the subgrantees, where they are, and we have all of that information on the main page of the Alaska Broadband Office. We have this really cool interactive map that the Division of Community and Regional Affairs put together that you can look at every single program and see every location that each of the – so, for example, with SPIT with SPOTS, if you wanted to look at – you can check SPITs with SPOTS on the interactive map, and it'll show you all the – locations that they're anticipating building to, as well as the by grant subgrantee amounts and broadband serviceable locations. How much time do I have left? Okay, I got a little bit. So we looked at the different compote of the projects, and this is our best estimate of how the broadband serviceable locations will be built out, both on an individual basis by fiscal year, as well as the cumulative to reach the total number of locations that we will be serving. You can see because we're in March, nearly in April of this year, with only a couple months left, it's a relatively small amount, probably taken up by either a wireless company or a satellite company. One of the key things, as you look a couple pages back at the grant awards, the Alaska Broadband Office was truly technology agnostic. There's some satellite, there's some wireless, and then there's some fiber. So, any questions?
Yes, I think so. We have about 10 minutes for questions with Director Lochner. I have Representative Himshute and then Holland.
Thank you, through the chair. Appreciate you being here. And I'm a learner in this field, but a frequent user of the technology that you work on. So I was concerned about, it looks like we lost a year in restructuring after the change in administration. So it looks like about a year of time was spent recalibrating. My concern is in that recalibration, I just believe that fiber is the durable solution that over time will cost less. Like, it's going to be there for a long time. It seems like we're going in a direction where we're not as focused on fiber. Can you speak to that? Am I wrong about that?
Two things. With the original provisional grantees, you can see that of the 46,000, two up from the bottom on this slide, the LEO satellites has 15,388. So that's about a third. The remainder is either a, as you said, a durable fiber solution or a wireless solution. And I can explain a little bit about those 15,000. There were certain communities, not many of them, but that just had no other bids. And there's a large number of those that we call Patsy's Cabin. And what those are is those are locations that are not part of a community out in the middle of a river bend. It just so happened that when I looked at the FCC's map, the first one I looked at is the only one that's labeled, and it's called Patsy's Cabin, which I've got a lot of history now on. So euphemistically, we call all of those non-community locations. There's about 8,000 or 9,000 of those. Again, that's not, we did not determine what the location composition would be. We were given that. So the LEOs cover all of those Patsy's Cabins, and then about 6,000 of the 46,000 locations. All the rest are either fiber or wireless.
Follow up. So through the chair, with those 15,000, and I'm guessing every single one of those is really grateful for the connectivity. My question is, what is the long-term picture for them? Will in 20 years, when the folks served by, well, let's just go with Igiagig Village, when Igiagig still has service, will those folks still have service? Is the investment going to have the same return?
Through the chair, and I apologize for not doing that the first time. Yes. And the reason being is that the LEOs, specifically SpaceX, and we met with them in DC 2 weeks ago, have committed to their version 2 and then version 3 satellites. And they almost get exponentially larger in the amount of capacity that each one can do. Now, these are future look notions. They don't have their version 3 birds up yet. But if that is in fact the case, then it will grow as the electronics for the fiber grow. Right? 20 years ago, when I was wet behind the ears in broadband, 45 meg was the pinnacle of technology. Mm-hmm. Now it's terabytes. And so we're anticipating that growth in the same way. There are some challenges. Found out I'm about to go down a rabbit hole, so you can stop me if this gets boring. That SpaceX is moving their satellites closer to the Earth, which creates a narrower beam and more bandwidth for a smaller amount of users. However, in a state like Alaska, that what I question them on is, okay, that's great, but that then means you need a whole bunch more in Alaska because we are so large. And so I asked them what their version 3 beam was, and that's proprietary at this point, but we're working with them to make sure that we do have that future proofing.
Final question. Sorry, comment. Really quick. I just remember there was a time when the LEOs served the equator, right? That's where the people are. And we out here on the ends of the earth, it was a bit of a struggle. I sent a spot message and it never went anywhere because it didn't get picked up. So that problem seems to be solved. But we're such a small market. I'm having a hard time, and love Starlink, love it, but have a hard time feeling like that's a great investment. So I'm going to trust what you said. Thanks.
Quick response through the chair. We're going to be monitoring them very closely, just like we'll be monitoring all of the subgrantees. And we'll make sure that they meet the commitments that they signed up for.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Holland.
Great. Thanks. Two things I wanted to ask about. One is, as we look at the new locations, and I was looking at the chart on page 10, I guess, is there a corresponding set of projects and awareness we need to have about energy needs in these areas that are now going to be picking up this service. I'm assuming if we have new broadband capability, we have more computers, we need to have more reliable power so the computers stay on and work. More people are going to be doing things with computers. Have you correlated this to any needs or gaps in energy-related projects to support the broadband connectivity?
Through the chair, that's outside the scope of the broadband office's charter, so I have not.
Okay. And then second question, follow-up?
Follow-up.
The other issue I've been following on this is the question of, are we providing any funding to help people do something with all of this new broadband? You might recall a conversation we had a year or more ago. I said, lots of money building all the hardware, but what are we doing to build the capability of people to use the hardware in terms of job training, remote workers, entrepreneurs, startup businesses, new technology? What's the update now in terms of, do we have any programs so that as these roll out to different communities, people have access to the resources, the training, the startups, the entrepreneurship, so that we're leveraging this connectivity into economic activity around the capability?
And through the chair, that was originally denominated in the Digital Equity Program, which the Trump administration canceled. But as you look at this slide, slide six, at the bottom, we're hopeful that some portion of the policy guidance that we will get from the NTIA, the reason we were back in D.C. is all of the states were meeting with the NTIA to give input on what that non-deployment fund should be. And so we're hopeful that the policy will have some portion of that to do exactly what you said, to have training and to get people using it in a meaningful way.
Great. Thank you. If there's an opportunity to help you with that or to nudge that along, let me know, because that's pretty important that we not only do this project, but we get good use out of the project when it's done. Thank you.
Thank you. And last question with this presenter will be Representative McCabe.
Thanks. Through the chair, I'm wondering about the Patsy's Cabin. You said there that you had a database. Do you have all those little places in there too?
Yes.
So we can go and find out if our off the grid house is in there.
Through the chair, yes. If you go to the interactive map on the broadband office's main webpage, and click on it, the way we had to do it is all of the LEOs are slightly smaller gray dots, because otherwise it just overwhelmed the map on a macro basis. But if you drill down on your off-the-grid location and there's a gray dot on it, then you're slated.
Cool.
Your own Patsy's Cabin will be connected.
No, I won't have to depend on this thing anymore.
Maybe you're a gray dot.
Yeah, maybe I'm Patsy.
We'll have to maybe change the name to Representative Cape's Cabin.
If it's very brief, I don't want to get too far behind here, but I do appreciate Director Lochner after this question, if you could stick around, because as we have time at the end, I'd be happy to bring up any of our presenters. Vice Chair Story.
Yes, thank you. Through the chair, thank you very much for being here today. I've been very interested in how this project is going. And I know our goal is, high quality, affordable internet for our residents. And this doesn't have to be answered right now, but I was wanting to know your opinion on how we're getting there. And what I'm worried about, we're putting all this the fiber and things in, but are we going to be able to afford to connect to it in our different areas? And who is going to be left out? I think that's really important when we changed in some of the digital equity pieces. If we can know who's going to be left out, then we can start thinking about what to do about those areas. Thank you.
Just very briefly through the chair, the way the program is contemplated now, no one is left out. Every single broadband serviceable location that was identified to us is served or will be served.
Thank you, Director Lochner. And again, if you'd like to stick around, we would really appreciate having you. Next on our presentation list is GCI. We have for this presentation, Billy Wayland, Senior Vice President of Corporate Development, presenting over Teams. Mr. Whalen, just so you know, in the room, our committee aide is going to be going through the slides. So if you just say next slide, we'll go ahead and advance those for you here in the room. And if you'd like to please put your name on the record and go ahead with the presentation. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. Chair and members of the committee, good afternoon. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today and for the committee's interest in the state's implementation of the BEAD program. For the record, my name is Billy Whalen. I am the Senior Vice President of Corporate Development at GCI. For the past 6 years, I have led GCI's Rural Connectivity Initiative, which is responsible for setting our long-term strategy for better connecting rural Alaska and successfully executing on that vision. While it wasn't in the beginning, federal infrastructure grants have become a critical part of this initiative, supporting GCI's efforts to close the digital divide in some of the hardest to serve parts of the state. Done right, these grant programs support economic opportunity, access to healthcare, and improved educational outcomes in rural Alaska that benefit the entire state. I'm here to talk about GCI's participation in one of those programs, Alaska BEAD, and what we think policymakers should be considering regarding BEAD non-deployment funds that were not used for infrastructure awards. GCI was founded over 40 years ago by Ron Duncan, who still serves as our CEO. During that time, we have invested over $4 billion building out a network to serve more than 240 communities. We have made our private investment go further by leveraging federal grant programs. You can go to the next slide. This map shows GCI's terrestrial network, much of which has been constructed in the last 10 years. GCI focuses on building durable, scalable networks supported by a sustainable business model that can be operated, maintained, and upgraded for decades. That long-term approach is essential in Alaska, where infrastructure deployments are challenging and expensive and must serve communities over decades. GCI also focuses on building reliable, diverse networks wherever possible. As a recent example, GCI partnered with CordovaTel, the local provider in Cordova, investing in the construction of a new subsea fiber route into Juneau. This fiber will bring the latest technology and a critical additional layer of redundancy for the state capital. We're targeting deployment of that fiber in 2027 to 2028. You can go to the next slide. Before diving into specific projects, it's helpful to briefly discuss the technology toolkit GCI and other providers deploy in Alaska. Alaska is a big state, and all of these technologies have roles to play. Fiber is the gold standard where feasible because of its longevity, reliability, and virtually unlimited capacity. GCI has long relied on microwave to provide terrestrial service to much of Western Alaska over our Terra network. And although it does not have the same capacity as fiber, we expect to continue to use this network to provide diversity and resiliency for our services. And finally, satellite service, and particularly lower Earth orbit satellites, are an increasingly important part of the telecommunications ecosystem. BEAD was implemented as a technology-neutral program, and Alaska awards wisely utilize all of these. You can go to the next slide, please. GCI's Rural BEAD Award will support the expansion of our IHUC network in Western Alaska. So let me take a minute to describe that project. It is shown on this map in blue and a little bit of green. IHUC is a partnership with Bethel Native Corporation and is supported by four grants by NTIA and the USDA RUS program. Excluding this BEAD award, this network will serve 14 communities, bringing urban internet plans and pricing to roughly 14,000 Alaskans. It includes more than 800 miles of middle mile fiber going under the ocean, over the tundra, on pole lines, and across rivers. Within each community, GCI is deploying fiber local access networks to each home and business. This project represents a long-term sustainable investment in this region. And I'm excited to report that the IHUC network is now up and running. Last year, GCI finished phase one of this project, turning up fiber internet and wireless service in five IHUC communities, including Bethel. In fact, GCI turned up fiber service to 13 rural communities just last year, including eight additional communities on Kodiak and along the Aleutian chain as part of our AU Aleutians project, which can be seen on that map down the Aleutians. This is making a difference in these communities today. You can advance to the next slide, please. And here is our primary BEAD project, shown on this map in red. GCI's $115 million BEAD award will support the expansion of the IHUC network to 16 additional communities in Western Alaska and more than 2,300 households and businesses. To make this project more cost-effective, GCI heavily leveraged its existing Terra microwave network to provide short, high-capacity extensions from fiber endpoints into communities. Where you see a solid red line, GCI is using BEAD funding to build new fiber. Where you see an orange dashed line, we're using our existing microwave to deliver capacity to communities. And within each community, again, we're constructing fiber to the prem. Regardless of technology, the IHUC BEAD network will be able to deliver gigabit speed internet service and support high-speed wireless in all communities. Altogether, the IHUC network will connect at least 30 Western Alaska communities, making it a true regional network. If you can go to the next slide, please. GCI also received two smaller BEAD grants for Anchorage, totaling $5.9 million towards a roughly $10 million project, so including private capital contributed by GCI. This project will deliver fiber service for the first time to approximately 900 unserved and underserved households in Ship Creek, Rabbit Creek, Bear Valley, and South Fork and Eagle River. These urban BEAD funds ensure equity within communities and not just between them. And if you can go to my last slide, please. So finally, as policymakers consider how remaining non-deployment BEAD funds should be used, we encourage a focus on three areas. First, ensuring project success through efficient permitting and targeted relief where supply chain constraints challenge projects. The entire country is about to start building, and we're already seeing challenges, for example, in local fiber availability. Second, strengthening existing statewide networks. This includes network hardening to mitigate the impacts of natural disasters, like we saw in the wake of Typhoon Halong, and funding the upgrade of technology used by the state and to support public safety. And finally, promoting economic development. The biggest one here, which is already on NTI's radar, are projects to accelerate the deployment of data centers. This represents an enormous economic opportunity for the state to export a highly in-demand services. We're at a very exciting moment right now. As Director Lochner mentioned, just a few days ago, NIST approved the Alaska BEAD Awards. This brings us to the finish line of the first round, getting projects funded. That puts us at the starting line of the second round, where we actually get to build infrastructure. I'd like to thank Director Lochner and his team for their efforts in getting us here. It's been a long journey. Thank you again for the opportunity to testify and for your leadership on broadband. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Excellent. Thank you very much for your testimony, Mr. Rayland. And do we have any questions for GCI at this time? All right. I'm just going to see if anybody... I'll go to Representative Holland and then him shoot this time. Great.
Thank you. Through the chair to Mr. Whalen. Similar question I asked last time, but I'm particularly curious with the economic development lens and in rural Alaska. Do you see some programs or are you aware of programs that are helping people leverage the use of this broadband capability as it comes into their communities? And do you have some thoughts on what strategies we might use to get the maximum benefit out of this new capability and connectivity?
So some of the earlier grant programs allowed for training funds to contribute to that sort of workforce development. For example, our NTIA Tribal Broadband Connectivity Program, that was our first IHUC project, included grant funds, and we partnered with Ute in Bethel to do multiple rounds of essentially technician 101 training to support a local and regional workforce. We have also been working with several nonprofits to provide cybersecurity and online safety programs. I think it's right that that while getting high quality connectivity to these communities is a critical first step, it's not by itself what's needed to really allow them to see the economic development that I think we're all hoping, and more could be done in that space. And Representative Holland, I support your efforts to focus legislation on those exact issues.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hinshute.
Thank you, through the chair. Thanks for helping me learn a lot today. My question is for those rural and remote sites that will be served through your BEAD grant, will they have urban equivalent bandwidth or speed, I guess, and pricing?
Thanks for asking. That has been one of our core principles for GCI's delivery of service to these rural projects. In every community that we're reaching by fiber, our plan is to deploy urban plans with urban pricing. And that's what you are already seeing in Bethel, as well as earlier deployments in Nome and Kotzebue, and small communities such as Eek that we've already turned on outside of Bethel. So they can buy the same 2.5 gigabit per second plan that GCI provides in Anchorage, our red plan, for the exact same price. For our microwave communities, just because microwave does not have the same capacity, we're not able to reach the same top speeds, but we can still provide gigabit speeds, which are substantially faster than what's provided over terrestrial service today in those communities, and should be sufficient bandwidth for many years to come.
Yeah, thank you. Through the chair, thanks for that response. So then, can you talk about scalability? So the places right now that are served by microwave, can that be upscaled so that they do have faster speeds down the road for similar cost? Is that, like, what does the future look like, I guess?
Yeah. I do not expect that those middle mile shots, those microwave shots, are going to become the capacity constraint for high quality bandwidth in those communities. What tends to fall behind on technology is local access. Once you're in the community, reaching to individual households, and we're using fiber for local access, with a fiber endpoint for those microwave shots, we'll be able to deliver multiple gigabits to small communities on the order of 1 to 200 people. If we need to later on, I expect that technology will continue to develop on the microwave front as well to upgrade. But again, we do capacity modeling for these communities to make sure we can hit that gigabit speed and see available capacity for many years to come.
One final follow-up. Thank you. Thanks for the latitude. Then through the chair, my last question has to do with service. You're serving some really remote places. So getting the BEAD grant and putting in the infrastructure is great. What does maintenance, or if there's an outage, what does that look like? And then I'm just going to tack on another question. I see a trunk line going right around Baranoff Island up to Juneau through Chatham Strait. And wouldn't it be lovely if some portion of that were to serve Sitka as well? But anyway, the question was about was about service and maintenance in these remote places. What does that look like
after the BEAD grant? Thank you for that question. And that is certainly top of mind for us. How do you provide high quality service for years to come? And so the first answer is we focus on building these networks in the most resilient manner possible. So just as an example, when we lay a cable landing station where these fibers come into the community, we'll put in diverse equipment and diverse power systems to make sure that if one fails, another is in the wings. Second, wherever possible, and unfortunately for these locations, sometimes it's not, we put in diverse fiber or diverse other backhaul to the communities so that even if there is a complete outage, we can reroute traffic to those same communities. And then third, and especially for GCI, we've been operating in the YK Delta directly or through our subsidiary for over 40 years. We have a workforce there of over 50 technicians. And so we already have the infrastructure there to maintain both our existing network and the additional network that we're going to be deploying here. And so it's always been a core focus of us, of GCI, to make sure we have a sustainable business model. This isn't a flash in the pan sort of project, and we're able to maintain it. And we're confident that with this new build, BEAD, as well as the IHUC network that I put on the screen, we'll be able to maintain it for the longevity of the system itself.
And aligned to Sitka. Okay, thank you.
Vice Chair Story?
Yes, thank you, Chair Carrick. Through the chair, I thought of a question before I go to the question I'd wanted to ask. And when we talk about our workforce, and it's good to know that you have quite a strong workforce, I'm trying to remember, is GCI work through AvTech to do training for a lot of your technicians? And how well is the pipeline going to the different high schools that we have to building the pipeline for GCI employees?
I know we have worked with AvTech in the past. I don't want to misstate this. Certainly continuing to develop a pipeline of talented young employees is key to our workforce. And we have a healthy intern program. But I need to look to just see what work we're currently doing with AvTech.
Follow up?
One follow-up, and then we're going to have to move on.
Okay. I can ask more questions about that later, and perhaps GCI can get back to us. But my question is, I hear data centers take a lot of energy. Do we have the energy capacity, the infrastructure to run data centers? And if so, in what areas and what areas do we not?
And this is a whole nother topic that you guys may have committee meetings on. So I'll just say a few things on that. Alaska is well suited to data centers generally because of its cold temperature, its abundant land, its freshwater resources, and to the extent they can be accessed, its energy resources. If you try to put a data center in an area right now that is energy constrained, that's not a good idea. But if you are able to bring the energy to locations that are well situated to data centers or deploy data centers in areas that are near the energy, then you have an opportunity to make some meaningfully economic development in the state.
Follow up. And you can answer this in a written question or at another time, but I guess I just really don't know what that looks like. How much energy do data centers take? What is the capacity needed?
Lots.
Yeah, I'd like a kind of grasp of that.
Read my Substack.
I think that'll be a really great follow-up, Mr. Wayland. And if you'd like to stay on the line, as we have time at the end, we will open it up for questions from any of our presenters. Last question for this presenter, Representative McCabe.
Thanks. So Mr. Wayland, I'd like to focus on the state, actually. You guys are a great business and you do great work. Are we in your way? How's permitting coming? Is there any permits needed across state parks? I see, like anything else in Alaska, we sitting around this table are the biggest impediment to business around, and permitting seems to be one of those places. So are you struggling with permits from the DNR or from state parks, for instance?
Permitting is always kind of front and center in any large rural project. I wouldn't say anything at the exact moment. I think as you have a lot of stacking projects coming along, including through the BEAD program, you are going to start seeing challenges, which is why fully staffing permitting agencies is going to be critical to not ending up with having that as a roadblock. It's not unusual for permits to come in kind of just in time. When you have short build seasons, that becomes pretty disruptive to projects. So we do our best to get permit requests in early, to respond to all questions from permitting agencies promptly. And I know that the individual employees at those agencies are hard workers and do their absolute best, but resourcing can be an issue.
Thanks.
And with that, again, if you'd like to stay on, Mr. Wayland, we'd really appreciate that. And thank you so much for your presentation today. We're going to go now to Alaska Communications. And we are joined in the room today with Heather Kavanaugh, our Vice President of External Affairs for ACS. And so thank you, Ms. Kavanaugh. For this presentation, we will have, unfortunately, another hard cutoff at about 4:25. Including questions. So thank you so much for being here.
Great. Thank you, Chair Carrick, and to the committee. Thank you for having me here today. My name is Heather Kavanaugh. And I serve as Vice President of External Affairs at Alaska Communications. We are very excited to be participating in Alaska's Broadband Equity Access and Development Program. So today I'd like to share just a little bit about our company and then spend the most of our time on an overview of the projects that we will be doing and what you can expect next. So Alaska Communications is a broadband and managed IT services provider. We've been serving Alaskans for over 120 years. We own and operate a statewide fiber optic network with over 150,000 miles of fiber. And we own and operate two of the subsea cables that connect Alaska to the lower 48. Our customers include everybody from some of the largest oil and gas companies to the state of Alaska, local governments and communities, small businesses, schools and health care clinics, and of course, customers at home. And we all know how critical broadband is for commerce and economic growth. Our mission at Alaska Communications is to change lives through technology. Our values include being team first and customer focused, and we take that very seriously. And you'll see that in some of the material that I share today. Our vision is to be the employer and provider of choice, connecting Alaskans to each other in the world. And we're so excited that this program will help us do more of that. So Alaska Communications applied for and received $124.5 million through the state BEAD program to build high-speed, affordable, reliable broadband to over 9,000 locations and 20 communities in our state. Alaska Communications will invest alongside this $26.7 million to reach an additional 12,000 locations. And this is a list of all of the communities that we'll be building in, and I will share maps of what we plan to do in each of them. We will use a mix of fiber and fixed wireless technology to deliver a minimum of 100 megabits per second and up to a gigabit. And I thought I'd pause here and just talk a little bit about what that means. So megabits and gigabits simply measure how fast data moves to and from your home or business. So you could think of the internet like a highway. 100 megabits is like a solid two-lane highway. And a gigabit is like a wide, modern freeway with lots of lanes. The more lanes you have, the more activities that can happen at the same time without slowdowns. 100 megabits will allow telehealth appointments, distance learning, remote work, use of smart home devices, and of course, streaming from multiple devices. our prices, it's very important to us that we make the services affordable, and we will offer competitive prices and urban rates in all of these communities. For example, we offer high-speed, unlimited internet with no data cap, starting at just $79.99 a month. The grants, as you heard earlier today from Director Lochner, have just passed final review with the National Institute of Standards and Technology. The state will soon have about a six-month timeline to formalize grant agreements, and once that is done, we will have 4 years to deploy and build our projects. And our goal is to get that done faster. So here's a look at some of the communities that we'll be building to. In Anchorage, Indian Hope, and please let me know if you'd like me to pause and stop on any of the maps. Delta Junction, this will be primarily fiber fed. The Fairbanks North Star Borough. The Kenai Peninsula. Kodiak, and this is where we will be building a subsea fiber from connecting to our network in Homer to Kodiak Island. Manly Hot Springs and Minto and Fort Yukon. So as far as next steps, construction planning is currently underway. We are working closely with local communities. We've reached out to every tribal entity that we'll be working with, and we plan to share updates with all of you and all of our stakeholders along the way. And we're very grateful for the legislature's support of broadband and our state for forming the Alaska Broadband Office. We're grateful for Director Lochner and his team and their work, and we thank Governor Dunleavy and the Alaska Congressional Delegation for all the work that's gone into this program. And I'm happy to answer any questions you have.
Oof, that was a whirlwind.
Amazingly fast.
That was as fast as the broadband that we're talking about. Love the pictures. Thank you very much for presenting. Questions for Ms. Kavanaugh? Representative Holland, and then I am looking at Representative St. Clair in advance, too. Just want to make sure they have a chance to ask questions. We'll go Representative Holland, and happy to have repeat questions, too. It's
fine. Great. Two questions, both related around dollars and cents. I'm curious, your data, thank you for it, is an interesting lens into this. If I look at the overall cost of the entire project across the entire broadband initiative, it's, I think, comes out at about $13,600 per connection. And if I look specifically at the ACS connection costs, the BEAD awards come out at $13,700 a connection, about the average of the overall project, a lot of money per connection. And I look at the ACS investment, of the $26 million, it comes in at about $2,000 a connection. And all of that is pretty dramatic when you think about the amount of money per connection to do that. But I'm wondering what your thoughts are or what you might share with us about why we see such a significant cost for these BEAD connections, and also what's happening when we see a fairly dramatic lower cost with the ACS connections, and just kind of what's the nature of the projects and the effort that's being required to do these projects and the difference.
Through the chair, thank you for the question, Representative Holland. The nature of the BEAD program is to get to unserved locations first. So they're some of the most remote locations, and that is why it's so expensive to get to them. And then the cost that Alaska Communications is putting in to get to additional locations, those are locations that are nearby that we can upgrade. So while we're already in an area, we'll be going to those locations. Okay. So it helps bring that cost down.
Follow up? Great, thanks. And then to follow up on that, as we look at the rates that people will have, and it's really impressive to think that our residents around the state are going to enjoy urban rates. I also, though, think about rates for utility services as having a portion of that rate that's capital recovery. that we charge rates in order to pay for the infrastructure and pay for the operation. And I'm curious, given the significant amount of money, particularly in the BEAD awards, how much of that is being able to pay the full or maybe a portion of the capital costs, and how much remains that requires any sort of capital recovery in the rates? Or is this paying for all of the capital so the rates are just O&M type of costs associated with that?
Through the chair, thank you for the question, Representative Holland. The BEAD awards are just a one-time capital award to build the initial infrastructure, and then rates help recover the cost of delivering the service, maintenance, and repair, the time that it takes for employees to go out and install, et cetera.
Thank you.
Thank you. And do we have anyone else in the queue? Representative Himshute?
Yeah. Thank you, through the chair. I'm still trying to understand. So this is all last mile. Everything. I'm a little lost here. I thought we were mostly doing middle mile, but it looks like you guys are doing last mile. So is there middle mile already in place for these places?
Through the chair, that's a great question, Representative Himshute. And yes, there is middle mile mostly available in all of these locations, except for Kodiak Island. The communities that we're going to, we're building middle mile to the south side of the island.
Quick follow-up.
Follow-up.
So then that last mile investment is what's needed in those other places. You've got everything else. Now you just need to get it to the home. And then what kinds of rates will they pay? Will that be parity at that point with the BEAD support?
Through the chair, yes. So the BEAD, the locations that we're going to are primarily last mile, and consumers will be paying the same rate as in urban locations like Anchorage and Fairbanks.
That's fabulous. Okay, thank you.
And I had put myself in the queue, Ms. Kavanaugh. I am curious about the two maps, one of Minto and then one of Fort Yukon. And it looks like in Minto, every household is going to be hooked up, which is really exciting. And then the Fort Yukon map, it's very scattered compared to where it appears that the population is. And I'm just wondering if you can elaborate on why Fort Yukon's map looks so different.
Yes, thank you for the question. That's a great question, Chair. So Alaska Communications is also really proud to be partnering with Doyon to construct another project that is bringing high-speed fiber to Fort Yukon. And so as we looked at all of the locations in Alaska, we saw that there were a handful in Fort Yukon that hadn't qualified for the other program that's paying for the Doyon project. It's the NTIA Tribal Broadband Connectivity Program. There were a handful of households that had been left out, and we were able to get those funded. So every household and business in Fort Yukon will have fiber to it. And they may have been homes that were constructed since that other grant had been applied for. So great question. Thank you.
And then I guess a follow-up to that is we were talking earlier about variable rates for urban versus rural Alaska, and with the different ways that folks in Fort Yukon are going to be connected, is there an anticipated difference in pricing for the Doyon versus the ACS?
All of our rates will be the same flat rate in Anchorage, Fort Yukon, Kodiak, the Kenai Peninsula. Everybody would be paying the same rate at the rate that they choose. Our rates start at $79.99 a month, and you can go up from there if you want faster speeds. But that's starting at 150 megs, which is a really good speed.
And I guess one more follow-up is, do folks in all of these smallest communities in Alaska, do they have the whole range of options starting with the $79.99, and do they have the whole range of options up to the fastest plans available?
Yes. Thank you for the question, Chair. Yes, they will have a range of plans starting at the $79.99 for 150 megs going up to, if it's available in their area, up to a meg or beyond.
Excellent. Thank you. Vice Chair Story, and then we'll go Representative Holland.
Thank you. Through the chair, I didn't ask GCI, but I remember they have a plan if you are on a lower income, if you have a lower income, and I'm wondering if you offer such a plan.
Yes, thank you, through the chair. We do participate in the FCC's Lifeline program. Most of the telecommunications companies in Alaska participate in that. And so I just looked up the rates when you had asked the question earlier to make sure I had the latest data. And today, if you're on tribal land, which most of Alaska is considered tribal land at the FCC, you can get a $34.25 discount on your internet bill. And if you're not on tribal land, that's a $9.25 discount.
Thank you.
Thank you, Vice Chair Story. We'll go last question for this presenter to Representative Holland.
Thank you, Chair Carrick. I'm going to hold my question and maybe bring it back with Mr. Lochner at the end. Thanks.
All right. Well, thank you, Ms. Kavanaugh. I really appreciate that rapid fire presentation and excellent answers. And if you'd like to stick around, we'd really appreciate that too.
Thank you for the opportunity to be here.
Great. We will move back to another of our online presenters at this time. Next, we're going to welcome Matthew Glover, the Broadband Program Manager at Tanana Chiefs Conference, to talk about BEAD program deployment in one region. Of course, there's multiple examples, but we asked TCC to come and speak with us. And Mr. Glover, just so you know, if you say next slide, we'll go ahead and advance those here in the room for you. And our committee is up at the dais ready to do that. So thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for the opportunity. Thank you, Chair Carrick and members of the committee. I'm Matthew Glover, Broadband Program Manager for Tanana Chiefs Conference. Like I said, I appreciate the opportunity to speak about BEAD, both the opportunities it represented and the challenges that we've experienced with it. Next slide, please. So first, a little bit about TCC. We serve 42 rural interior Alaska villages across an area the size of Texas. 30 of them have health clinics, 32 of them have schools. Our mission, as far as the broadband division of our infrastructure department is concerned, is to provide high-speed internet in our rural communities at the same price available in urban communities, build tribal capacity and ownership of those broadband assets, and create local jobs that keep the economic benefits in our villages. Currently, we're managing about $78 million in active broadband grants across 10 programs, and we're building permanent fiber infrastructure in some of the most remote communities in the nation, as are the other presenters here. Next slide, please. Under BEAD, TCC submitted two applications. The first was a $91.4 million application for 1,008 locations across five Yukon River communities, Ruby, Galena, Nulato, Koyukuk, and Caltag. We were proposing an XGS passive optical network fiber backbone that would have been capable of up to 10 gigabit speeds. It would have also connected TCC's two Yukon River corridor reconnect projects, in addition to connecting to the Doyon project that Ms. Kavanaugh was just mentioning. And basically, it would have made a single continuous terrestrial fiber backbone across the state, which would have been a first for interior of Alaska. And our cost was around $90,654 per location. The state broadband office identified additional unserved communities after our initial application south of Ruby. TCC submitted a second proposal, $32.1 million for 379 locations in McGrath, Nicolai, and Takotna. And our BSL cost for that was $84,720 per location. So combined, it was about $123 million for 1,387 locations and a continuous fiber backbone through the interior. We were provisionally awarded that project. And that's kind of what we were looking at in the early stages. The benefit of the bargain policy change in June 2025 eliminated the fiber first preference and made lowest upfront costs the determining factor. TCC still believes fiber is the right investment for these communities, and I'll go more into that here in a bit. In January 2026, ABO told us our costs were too high and asked for best and final offer. We tried everything to get our costs down. We reduced from five communities down to two. We dropped the entire Ruby to Takotna corridor. We even explored alternative middle mile technologies. We worked with Pacific Data Port on a satellite backhaul solution to reduce our per location cost. And in the end, we got it down to under $50,000 per location. serving 682 locations for $34.1 million. On January 30th, Director Lochner rejected our best and final offer due to it not being the lowest price, and it was not appealable. The communities, as far as we're aware, were awarded to another provider at $48.8 million for 1,008 locations. Next slide, please. This slide shows what TCC originally proposed compared to what was ultimately selected. Our fiber proposal would have delivered up to 10 gigabit speeds, the same capacity available in Anchorage and Fairbanks. What was selected, at least for now, will deliver 100 over 20 megabits. That was the minimum speeds that BEAD allowed. Our middle mile was 432 miles of all terrestrial fiber, which would have been a permanent backbone. What was selected includes 265 miles of fiber over 400 river miles, meaning the microwave links, as previously discussed, will be filling in the gaps. Fiber cable lasts 25 to 50 years. Microwave electronics typically need replacement every 7 to 10 years. And if you look at the last two rows on that chart there, TCC's proposal meant tribal ownership, permanent asset controlled by the communities it serves with local jobs and local revenues. And what was selected was an external provider model. We're still really thrilled that those communities will be served. But, you know, we are really trying to bring more economic development opportunities to those communities through this program as well, not just connectivity. And I do want to say that we're not trying to criticize any of the other providers. You know, we're thrilled, like I just said, that there's going to be connectivity in some underserved areas. It just illustrates how TCC's proposals reflect our mission, which is investing in permanent assets, local jobs, and tribal control that advance sovereignty and self-determination. Next slide, please. And I'll explain a little bit why this matters in Alaska specifically. Microwave and satellite links depend on remote generators that need regular refueling, towers that often require helicopter access, and electronics that fail in extreme cold. Just this winter in Cowtag, one of our TCC Village clinics lost internet for weeks in the middle of winter, like I said, because the DRS microwave link went down. And just due to weather and other environmental conditions, nobody could get out there to repair it in time. And that just happens sometimes here. There's nothing we can do about it. Fiber is a little bit different, though. It's passive infrastructure. There's no remote power needed, typically. There's regeneration stations, but those can be spread out over hundreds of miles. There's no shared bandwidth degradation. You know, you're competing for airspace, so they say, shooting signals wirelessly. Once fiber's on the ground, it just works. There's no replacement cycle. There's no helicopters or generators needed. Life cycle costs kind of factor into that, too. There's been newspaper articles saying GCI spends approximately $1.5 million a year just refueling their microwave towers by helicopter. And we're looking at operation and maintenance for microwave at 10 to 15% of its capital per year. And over 20 years, these technologies can cost the same or even more than fiber while delivering far less capacity. Next slide, please. And something that doesn't get discussed nearly enough is that none of these rural projects work without other ongoing federal subsidies, kind of regardless of the technology. TCC's 30 clinics currently pay between $28,000 and $75,000 per month each for satellite and microwave internet. And that's mostly funded through the USAC Rural Healthcare Program. And that kind of continues indefinitely. As was mentioned previously, BEAD covers construction only. Every BEAD project in rural Alaska, fiber, microwave, or satellite requires these ongoing USF high cost, E-rate, rural healthcare subsidies to remain operational after construction. So after every technology is already requiring the ongoing federal support, doesn't it make sense to invest in the one with the lowest annual operating cost, which would be the fiber that I'm discussing? Lower O&M means lower ongoing subsidy dependence. When we choose higher O&M technologies to save on upfront construction, we're trading one-time federal investment for an indefinite annual federal obligation. Next slide, please. If we look back at the statewide picture, Alaska's $629 million BEAD program is serving 46,192 locations across 15 subgrantees, but only 51% of those locations are getting fiber. 32% are low Earth orbit satellite, 13% are fixed wireless, and 4% are a hybrid of both, which means nearly 23,000 homes are receiving technologies with shorter equipment lifespans. We should be planning now for how those systems need to get replaced and upgraded in 7 to 15 years, which brings us back to kind of a broader BEAD question, is how do we ensure this one-time federal investment in the state is building durable, sustainable infrastructure that fulfills BEAD's goals of long-term reliable broadband access for rural communities? Next slide, please. The BEAD program was just one piece of TCC's broadband vision. The rest is still moving forward. We're recipients of a Reconnect 3 award through the USDA for $30.3 million. We're building a fiber backbone from the Dalton Highway all the way to Hughes, which is going to connect with another award that was given to Atotchinkin under the Reconnect 5 program, which is going to connect to us in Hughes, and we'll be able to build a continuous fiber all the way from the Hall Road out to Kotzebue. So the next time there's a fiber strike in the ocean, hopefully they'll have a alternative route to get that traffic through. We're also awarded a project under Reconnect 4. We're working with ACS on that one. We're hoping to bring fiber to Circle, Chalkeets, and Kaminitai, building onto the network that ACS is already developing in Port Yukon. We have two different TBCP grant programs that we're working on. $15.5 million combined there. We're delivering fiber to the home in Eagle, Nanana, Northway, Tanacross, Dot Lake, and five other communities. And as I previously mentioned, USDA confirmed support for linking together the Reconnect 3 and Reconnect 5 projects, creating that continuous fiber backbone throughout the state. BEAD could have extended this backbone to the Yukon River communities and south to McGrath. And we kind of feel like that was a missed opportunity. Next slide, please. Here's four recommendations we have for the committee. If and when opportunities like this come up in the future, first, evaluate the total cost of ownership. Funding decisions should weigh 20-year life cycle costs, O&M, equipment replacement, and ongoing subsidies, not just upfront construction costs. Fiber delivers the lowest long-term cost per megabit, period. Second, prioritize tribal ownership and workforce development. BEAD should advance tribal self-determination. TCC's proposals included local ownership of infrastructure and paid workforce training. The selected approach keeps these communities dependent on outside providers with no ownership stake and no specific local jobs created through these programs. Third, reform permitting and scoring criteria. Environmental permitting, as we're all aware, adds 18-plus months and millions in cost to all of these fiber projects, and that's ultimately what inflated our proposals. Scoring that only weighs lowest upfront prices per location, structurally disadvantages fiber and disadvantages remote communities where deployment costs are inherently higher. So scoring should account for infrastructure lifespan, tribal consultation, and total cost of ownership. And fourth, plan now for replacement costs, because nearly half of BEAD locations got non-fiber technologies with 7 to 15-year equipment lifespans. Alaska needs a funding plan for those replacements before the costs arrive. Next slide, please. And just in closing, we're not here over one grant application. The question is whether federal broadband dollars are actually building lasting, locally owned infrastructure for Alaska Native communities. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Glover, and appreciate you being here. Do we have questions for Mr. Glover? Quiet room right now. Representative Hemshoot.
You know you can count on me. Mr. Glover, thank you for being here. Through the chair, those applications that were rejected, there's not a slide number, but it says what TCC proposed under BEAD. So the timeline of that, were they rejected kind of in that gap as we were transitioning from one federal administration to another? Is that the timeline for... Oh, I see down below you've got June 25. So this happened just last year?
That's correct. We were working with Director Lochner on our best and final offer, and there was just a lot of back and forth with our provisional award once it was accepted. You know, we I'm not trying to paint a bad picture or anything. We really, really appreciate all the help and willingness to work with us that Director Lochner was willing to do. But there was a lot of really quick turnaround. Basically, we'd get a notification that we needed to come up with a whole new project plan and have about 7 days to put it together, which did prove to be a little problematic at some points.
And follow up, ultimately, not fruitful. So,
unfortunately.
Yeah, okay. Well, thank you for that perspective and for bringing another way of looking at this. I appreciate that.
Vice Chair Story.
Yes, thank you. And this is just sort of a comment. I appreciate the presentation and I appreciate the recommendations. I'm just wondering, with knowing that fiber and the maintenance, lack of maintenance costs, if that is not taken into consideration in deciding what projects to go with, how is there like what would I call it? I want to say a grid because I'm thinking of electricity so much, but just like a rubric of what we're looking for and following. I mean, I think it's great recommendations that we always look at, you know, the maintenance and what it's going to cost. Mm-hmm. And so I'm wondering if there is a rubric such as that, and or maybe there's disagreement with the analysis of maintenance. And so I'd be interested at some point in knowing the answers to those questions.
Thank you, Vice Chair Story. And as time allows, we will bring Director Lochner back up to the dais. Do we have additional questions for Mr. Glover at this time? Representative Holland.
Thank you. Through the chair, I'm just kind of stuck on wow, but I'll move past that for the moment. And I appreciate the presentation and your thoughtfulness at being able to share like a unique perspective of these projects. In that, I guess for now, I just want to come back to the recommendations and your thought on this in terms of how do you see this project as having been connected to and beneficial to other activities that TCC is doing? I'm aware of some of your electrification projects and other workforce and community development projects, and I'm wondering, you know, how you saw this as developing workforce experience, capability, and capacity for other projects, and what would be ahead for you?
Yeah, thanks for that question. I mean, one of TCC's tribal primary missions is to advance tribal sovereignty, and I think a project like this falls right into that category. The more we can bring up the standards of living that everybody in an urban environment might be used to and can bring those opportunities to rural communities inside the TCC region and throughout all the rural communities in the state, I think that's a win for the communities themselves. It brings more opportunities. One of the big issues we're facing is our communities are shrinking because there's simply more opportunities in Fairbanks, for example, than there are in Allakaket. So if we bring more connectivity and more reliable connectivity out to those places, you know, that really improves the standards of living. There's also healthcare concerns. Right now we're dependent on a lot of microwave shots for our clinics and things of that nature. And like I illustrated in my presentation, if one of those shots goes down, that can really make life miserable for people that need help out there. And if, you know, there's just a health aide in that clinic and the person that has an emergency can't reach anyone through telehealth or telemedicine due to the internet being down, that's a real problem. So we saw bringing fiber to these communities is another way to alleviate that. Not to mention educational opportunities. I will say on the workforce development front, we are working with NTIA as an awardee of TVCP round two to bring a workforce development program to Holy Cross specifically to teach like programming and cyber skills and things of that nature. And we've budgeted for a I'll call it a pilot project for 13 students to go through that program. And it's aimed at, I'd say 18 to 25 year olds in those communities. So we're hoping if that works out, we can roll that out to other communities as well. But none of that's possible without reliable internet. So that's kind of where our perspective is. Hopefully that answers your question.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you for the additional detail, particularly bringing in the training, a connection that you're making that I was looking for in some of the other questions I'd asked earlier. Thank you for all this work that you've done to prepare. This is really valuable perspective.
Thank you, Representative Holland. And seeing no more questions at this time for Mr. Glover, I just want to thank you again for joining us. And if you'd like to stay on the line, we will happily come back to you if there are additional questions before the end of the hearing today. Thank you for joining us. So at this time, we're going to move to our final presenter for today, which is from Pacific Dataport. We do have the Vice President of Government Affairs and Strategy on Teams today, Mr. Sean Williams. Mr. Williams, if you would put yourself on the record and go ahead with your presentation. And as with the other presenters online, if you just want to say next slide, we're happy to advance the slides for you here in the room.
Yep, absolutely. I appreciate that. Can you hear me okay?
We can, thank you.
Okay, good afternoon, Chair Carrick and committee members. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today. For the record, my name is Sean Williams. I'm Vice President of Government Affairs and Strategy at Pacific Dataport, an Alaska-based satellite broadband and telecommunications company who is not represented by the Alaska Telecom Association. I've spent my career working in Alaska's telecommunications ecosystem, and I'm currently pursuing a PhD in UAF, focused on how federal broadband programs impact rural Alaska and access to healthcare as well. I wanted to include, let's go to the second slide, please. I wanted to include this slide to outline a short description of our company and what's coming in the next few years. This is ubiquitous competition that doesn't require CapEx funding to be built or further OpEx subsidies to stay in business. And remember, it's competition that brings prices down and speeds faster and actually improves customer service. That's exactly what we've seen. Starlink customers often see up to 400 megabits per second download and 120 megabits per second upload. And that's for about $120 a month with zero fiber break fears. I'm going to switch gears now and take off my company hat. And my goal is to simply share what I've observed from a policy, economic, and infrastructure standpoint so that you, as legislators, have the information you need to make informed decisions going forward. Let's go to the next slide, please. So this is slide 3. Alaska is about to deploy roughly $1 billion. At this moment, $629 million has been approved by the NTIA, and there's about $370 million left over for what's called non-deployment funds. The Alaska legislature should absolutely have a role in how this money is used. The decisions tied to BEAD investment will shape communications, healthcare, education, and public safety across the state for decades. At a high level, this is not just a broadband deployment program. It's a once-in-a-lifetime generational infrastructure investment. The intent of BEAD is to expand access, improve affordability, and close the digital divide. Those are important goals, and they are they're broadly supported. However, the scale of this funding means that execution matters just as much as intent. If done correctly, this program can significantly improve connectivity across Alaska. If done poorly, we risk locking in high-cost systems that may not be sustainable or competitive over time. One of the key concerns I want to highlight is that legislative visibility into the process has been limited. Many of the most consequential decisions have occurred without ongoing legislative engagement or oversight. So today is really about equipping you with a clearer picture of where things stand and where attention is needed. Slide 4, please. There are several areas where the process has raised concerns. First, there have been inconsistencies in how applications were evaluated and how decisions were made. I'm happy to provide detailed written examples, but at a high level, Some rules appear to shift over time. Second, the underlying data used to determine eligibility, the broadband service location data, is not fully accurate. There are cases such as ADAC where funding is tied to locations that are abandoned or and other places that do not exist. That creates inefficiencies and misallocation of funds. Third, there has been little to no formal oversight from the legislator during this process. Given the size of the investment, $1 billion, that's a structural gap worth addressing. Let's hope that doesn't happen with the Rural Health Transformation Fund, which is $1.4 billion coming to Alaska. Fourth, although this program is labeled as broadband, the impacts go far beyond internet access. These deployments directly affect legacy voice networks, private lines used by healthcare clinics, and other critical infrastructure. In some cases, these systems may be disrupted or displaced without a clear transition plan. Finally, except for the Industry Trade Association and the ABO director, the state of Alaska is currently does not have deep internal telecommunications expertise guiding these decisions, nor does it have clear authority aligned with the complexity of today's networks. Slide 5. This brings us to a broader issue, our regulatory framework. And this is kind of the meat and potatoes right here. Alaska's telecommunication statutes are rooted in a model that assumes copper-based telephone networks. That world is disappearing. We are rapidly transitioning to broadband-based systems, including voice over IP. The networks have evolved, but the regulatory language for telecommunications has not kept pace. The RCA, Regulatory Commission of Alaska, is following the law as written. The challenge is that the law itself no longer reflects how networks actually operate. This creates gaps in oversight, gaps in accountability, and uncertainty for providers and communities alike. There's a natural progression happening here. Telecommunications is no longer a standalone voice service. It is a broadband ecosystem that supports everything from telehealth to emergency response. Updating statutory language and regulatory frameworks is not optional. It is necessary to ensure the state can effectively govern this transition. At the federal level, the Telecommunications Act of 1996 is currently being reviewed and will likely be overhauled. But Alaska still needs to represent itself. Slide 6. Looking forward, there are several strategic risks that were not fully accounted for in BEAD decisions. One of the biggest is sustainability. We are entering a period of rapid technological change with low Earth orbit satellite systems such as Starlink are already operating in Alaska. The Amazon LEO system is expected to begin service within the next 2 years. And with early deployments, it's already happening in places like ADAC in Dutch Harbor and even Wrangell, Alaska. All of those will become active in the next couple of months. The two new systems introduce real competition, particularly in high cost and remote areas. We calculate the penetration rate in rural Alaska at somewhere between 50 and 60%, and it could be higher. If anyone's been to Nome lately, you can see there are Starlink terminals everywhere. The concern is that we're making long-term infrastructure investments without fully accounting for how these emerging technologies will affect demand, pricing, and network utilization. There are also middle mile challenges. In many parts of Alaska, middle mile capacity is limited. Some providers must transit multiple networks just to reach tier one internet or the main internet line in lower 48. That increases costs, which ultimately get passed on to customers and institutions. This is where some of Alaska's non-deployment funds should be spent, building middle mile that can back up fiber and open to all technologies. This is the perfect job for modern satellite technology. Another key point is that economic analysis was not consistently applied to funding decisions. When deploying public dollars at this scale, understanding long-term cost structures and competitive dynamics is critical. Without that, we risk building systems that are expensive to operate, and difficult to sustain. And slide 7. There are several practical steps the legislature can consider. First, establish a dedicated full-time telecommunications office, which covers everything, including broadband, but telecommunications is the network that it runs on, within the Department of Commerce. This ensures the state has in-house expertise and a consistent voice in both state and federal discussions, which we know are developing. Second, modernizing the statutes governing telecommunications and the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. This includes updating definitions, moving away from legacy copper assumptions. If you can just remember the copper lines that we used to use for phone lines, right? And aligning regulation with broadband and IP-based services. I'll include eliminating ETC approval oversight as well. The FCC can do this. The FCC can do this for Alaska, as they do for most other states. Third, increase legislative oversight and reporting requirements for BEAD implementation. Transparency and accountability will be key to ensuring outcomes match expectations. Fourth, ensure Alaska has a clear and active role in federal telecommunications policy and funding discussions. Right now, the state does not consistently assert a position, leaving it up to an industry trade association, and that leaves a serious gap. Finally, focus on protecting Alaskans. That means ensuring the investments being made today deliver affordable, reliable, and sustainable service over the long term. In closing, we can go ahead and go to the next slide if you'd like. In closing, I appreciate the opportunity to share these observations with you. This is a pivotal moment for Alaska. The decisions made over the next 1-2 years will define our communications landscape for decades. My goal was not to criticize, but to provide a clear-eyed view of where things stand and where there may be opportunities to strengthen the state's approach. I would be happy to provide additional detail in a meeting, written examples, or technical support as you continue to evaluate these issues. Thank you again for your time, your service to Alaska, and your attention to this important matter.
Thank you, Mr. Williams, for your presentation. Very appreciated. We do have some questions here. We'll start with Representative McCabe and then Representative Holland.
Not really a question, Sean. I just want to say thanks for all you and Chuck do for Talkeetna. It's got a special place in my heart, and you guys are awesome.
Thank you, sir.
Representative Holland.
Great. Thank you, through the chair. Good to hear from you. Thank you for the work you're doing on the broader issue, as well as what you're doing specifically in the satellite area. Two questions. One is just a quick, relatively simple one, and then another one is a policy question. On the technical question, the reliance on LEO, low Earth orbit satellites, is an interesting development that I see we're putting a significant amount of resources into in this broadband connection. And I'm just wondering what the state of the functionality of this technology is. My own personal experience which may be an outlier, but working in remote areas, is that it's great for downloads, buffered applications, asynchronous applications, but synchronous live video types of stuff, the satellite drops I've run into have been an interruption to being able to use it for high bandwidth synchronous applications. And maybe that's my own issue. Maybe that's a development phase we're in. But what's your view of the use of the low Earth orbit technology as broadly as we're using it, and for the types of uses people are going to expect it to be used for?
Thank you, Representative Holland. Through the chair, I would share that we have regular meetings with Starlink. We're probably one of their largest resellers in America. And we buy petabytes of data from them and resell them to the schools, the health clinics, the libraries, the mines. And there's kind of two different ways to do this. You can either have a community gateway, and then everyone is kind of hooked up to it through a network that's last mile in the community. Or you can have your own Starlink terminal right there on your cabin in the middle of nowhere. So those are kind of the two ways to do it. Both ways were affected by the fourth quarter doubling of capacity over the polar regions. So it's not necessarily just over Alaska when they double it. It's over the entire polar regions. But in fourth quarter, Starlink did double their capacity and, you know, basically took care of any small issues that were starting to pop up. But long story short, everyone is very happy, and it's easy to have multiple people using the same Starlink connection in the household, even live streaming.
Great. Well, I look forward to using it next time I get out to the cabin and see what's going on. The policy question, you made a really important connection, I think, between the State Broadband Advisory Board and possibly lessons we should learn from that or might apply to the Rural Health Transformation Program and advisory projects. That being said, I'm wondering, what do you see as the perhaps evolving role of the State Broadband Advisory Board as this project rolls out? Does it change? Does it have a different function? And in particular, I'm wondering if you've got any thoughts on the open positions, because it looks like right now the local government, the Alaska Native Corporation, the school board position, and the tribal positions, all four of those are open right now and not filled. And I'm wondering how that affects the board's function, and how should the board's function be evolving as this BEAD program is now rolling out?
You know, I'm glad that you asked me that, or I should say through the chair, that I'm glad you asked me that question. I attend all the meetings. I think Thomas might agree with me on that. I attend all the meetings, and over the last couple of years, ever since HB 363 created the Statewide Broadband Advisory Board, and then also the Technical Advisory Committee, I can honestly say that I cannot think of one thing, one point, one item, one suggestion that the board made and was implemented by the Alaska Broadband Office. So there's a sincere question about the function of the board and truly its effectiveness. I think they were kept up to date on everything, but I really didn't see any decisions or advisories come out of those. I'll also add that the Technical Advisory Committee was found to have a lot of, basically everybody was participating in that, you know, was working for a telecom that, had an interest in one kind of technology or the other. And long story short, it ended up being a conflict of interest. And so they ended up not doing that and ending that committee.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Hinshute.
Thank you, through the chair. I see here on one of your slides that a bullet point, current framework still assumes copper-based telephone exchange systems. Can you give an example of a specific example of what we need to change, in your opinion?
Yeah, so the way the current regulations are written, it assumes that everything's going down a copper line. And in the current world, everything's going down a fiber line. Everything is literally using the fiber to get everywhere it's going. And even the FCC, who regulates copper lines, has said in the last couple of months, we are fully retiring this regulation around copper lines and moving everything over to kind of broadband based. But you know, there are experts out there who can make the recommendations. I mean, we have people on our team that would love to make recommendations. I think collectively here we have over 300 years of telecom experience in our office, and including a former FCC commissioner as an advisor. So if this is something you'd be interested in pursuing as a topic, we enjoy a meeting and giving you suggestions in that area.
Follow up. So I keep hearing that once you put the fiber in, you're done. It's good to go. So tell me about this your suggestion that we don't, I mean, maybe I'm misinterpreting, but do you think that we need fiber at all? Are you thinking that we can do it all on satellite?
I think I'm talking to Representative Story.
We're the same. Representative Hemshoot.
Oh, Hemshoot. Okay, sorry. It's hard to see in the little picture. Representative Hemshoot, through the chair. That's a great question. Fiber is really, really impressive, and it is really, really good until it breaks. And I would probably share with you that, when the Gnome fiber break, when the Gnome fiber broke, the fiber coming into Gnome, when it broke, we got a phone call both times. But the second time, we were able to provide capacity, and you know, we're super happy for that opportunity, but we provided capacity to connect them to Starlink satellites. We paid $1 million for a gateway up there, and then they connected their fiber to it. And everyone in town, I went up there 2 months ago and filmed a video. Everyone in town thought the fiber was fixed, but it wasn't really fixed until it was fixed, right? And so for 10 months, they used Starlinks to keep that fiber connected with a community gateway. And that was a contribution that the Pacific Dataport made. And we were happy to do that. But it goes to show, though, that everyone can use these community gateways when a fiber breaks. But it hasn't really been adapted by the industry up here. And it's a little bit frustrating because there is a solution, but the broadband office didn't want to spend money on it. The telecoms don't want to spend money on it. And we have the solution in our back pocket, and things could be better, but it's doesn't happen.
Final follow-up. Thank you, through the chair. So my original question was, do you think that fiber is not needed? So I want to go back to that specific question.
Sure, I'll answer your question through the chair. Fiber is needed, and it has its place, just like Patsy's Cabins being connected with Starlinks has its place. So yes, the answer would be yes, we need fiber.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hemshoot, and thank you, Mr. Williams, again, for your presentation. At this point, I think we have about 15 minutes left, and I just want to open it up for questions for any of our presenters. And I'd like to start with Director Lochner, and I know that maybe we circle back around while Director Lochner's coming up. I'll just opine. I think today we heard some of the brightest highlights in the broadband and connectivity space, and we heard about some challenges. And so I'd like for Director Lochner, if you want to respond to anything that's been presented since your presentation, but I also have just a really basic question. How close are we to having every community in Alaska have some type of internet connectivity, reliable internet connectivity?
The full scope of the work that will get done will take the full 4 years. And so some communities will be able to be hooked up quickly. Some communities will take longer. In my slides, the slide that had the blue bars kind of shows that we'll get a lot of communities hooked up within the next 3 fiscal years. And then the last 2 fiscal years will take a bit longer because those are the ones that are really, really remote and are being served that with permits, environmental permits, regular permits that take a long time. So that help?
It does. I'm just going to follow up with, I guess let me define a community really quick. Like if communities with 100 or more people, are we getting very close, somewhat close, or not yet very close to having all of our major communities major being 100 or more people, say, are we getting, how close are we getting to having reliable internet connectivity for our communities?
As Mr. Whalen from GCI said, and to highlight Ms. Kavanaugh from ACS, if you look at Kodiak Island, Akiak is a community of about 100 households, I think, might be a little bit more. But that requires a subsea fiber to connect to Akiak through the program that was selected. That's going to require subsea permits, soundings, right? That's a multi-year project. Whereas Minto, for example, Minto is on a road system very close to the Dalton Highway and will take significantly less time, although Ms. Kavanaugh can correct me if I'm wrong.
So, feel free to correct me if I'm wrong. The answer I'm hearing is it varies tremendously across the state. But what I think we've also heard is we've made a lot of progress. And so we're probably, on the whole, while there are some major challenges, we're getting very close to everybody having internet access. And I'm seeing Ms. Kavanaugh sort of nodding her head too. Okay. Thank you for allowing me to ask you a question that forces you to opine. But I have Representative McCabe in the queue, and then I think a few others too.
Thanks, Chair Carrick. And this is probably for GCI. I'm not sure. I'd like to explore the fiber thing a little bit more, because a couple of years ago I said, well, how do you put fiber in permafrost across the mountains or the tundra or the swamps? And the answer was just lay it on the ground and let the ground grow over the top of it, I think, was the answer I got. Is that still kind of the way we're doing it? Or we actually have take a ditch witch out there 900 miles from the middle of nowhere and dig a ditch for it?
Through the chair, I have firsthand experience. Prior to coming to the state of Alaska, I worked for Arctic Slope Telephone Association Cooperative, and they did do a ground lay. You go with Argos in the summer, map the route with the GPS, go in the winter so you're not affecting the tundra, and lay the cable just on top of the snow, and then it goes into the tundra. And then it's not just regular old fiber that's about the size of your pinky. It's about the size of your thumb, and it's double armored jacketed subsea cable, so it's quite heavy. And when I last spoke to Jens Lipenex, who is the CEO of ASTAC, a year and a half ago, it was more than 90% sunk into the tundra. So it's a very, very low environmental impact solution to lay fiber over the tundra.
Sounds like a lot of mosquitoes in the summertime.
It'd be quite a job. I have Representative Holland and then Vice Chair Story.
Great. Thank you. Through the chair, I had a couple questions for Mr. Lochner following up on the discussion we've had. First off, just a simple question. As I was looking through the maps and the pictures from a couple of the presentations, it looked like, but perhaps I was misreading the maps and the scale, that there were areas that were either very close or overlapping. What was the strategy in the awarding of projects? Is there overlapping competitive environments in communities where they've got options and choices, so we have a little competition, or did everybody kind of get their little slice of Alaska that they largely have, you know, dare I say, a monopoly in that one little area? What's the strategy for what's going on there? And are there overlaps, or how are we controlling the distribution of who has access in different areas?
Thank you. Through the chair, the BEAD program did not allow for multiple funding for the same broadband serviceable location. So as a consequence of that, in order to follow the rules, we had to award only one provider access to that broadband serviceable location.
Thanks. Mm-hmm. Follow up. Thank you.
Through
the chair, going to the TCC presentation, I'm a bit shocked, quite frankly. It's a very compelling picture of local capacity and local capability to have done the project. And as I, you know, calculate the numbers there, it looks like in the end there was about a 1% difference between the broadband service location cost of one provider versus the one that was given the project. And it's just unfathomable to me that given all the benefits for local self-determination, capability, workforce development, ownership, that we didn't figure out how this would have gone to a local organization to do that. And I'm just wondering why I shouldn't be maybe as surprised as I am about that outcome. What is there something in the factors at work here that made it so compelling that we couldn't allow the local organizations to have been able to pursue this?
Through the chair, yes. So there were a couple of factors that were constraining. The first is the BEAD restructuring policy notice from June of June 6, 2025. In that policy notice, it said fiber is no longer the gold standard. You cannot use fiber as a preference. You have to accept all technologies, and including unlicensed fixed wireless and LEO. And there was a preference or an outline of how to incorporate those. And then further, the restructuring policy notice had a very strict guidelines that said the assistant secretary and the secretary of commerce could determine whether a program was too expensive or not. And so when we made our provisional awards, we were very excited about them, and TCC had won two of them. And then the NTIA came back to us and said, no, these are too expensive, justify them. So we did. And we went back and justified and made that case. The NTIA in early January came back and said, these seven, the highest per broadband serviceable location, are still too expensive. You have 72 hours to do run a BAFO and get it back to us. Mr. Glover talks about a week, we actually petitioned for an extension to make sure that folks, we knew it was we petitioned for 2 weeks, we got a week and a half. And so through all of this, NTIA has been a very good partner, but has set some very, very strict rules and guidelines which we had to follow.
Okay. Thank you for the additional explanation and for what sounds like a lot of work you were doing to try and thread the pathway for this. Just a brief follow-up or final question. On the question about the State Broadband Advisory Board, given what you've learned, what might we be doing next with that advisory board to make it helpful to the work ahead at this point? And what lessons are we learning about an advisory board we might apply to other boards that may come up? But any follow-up for us on the advisory board?
Like Mr. Williams, I attended every meeting because I sit on the meeting as not only the broadband director but also the commissioner's seat. And as we move from, there's different stages we've gone through. First, we had to declare the dilemma. What is the challenge with broadband in Alaska? And we did that 2 years ago. Then we had to move through the funding process, and we just got that approval. Now we're in the implementation stage. And I think as we implement, one of the exciting things that we will have that's required by the NTIA, and we're embracing it fully, is two things. Permitting roundtables to help expedite permitting, as well as a dashboard that shows for every single broadband serviceable location what the status of that is. Is that in permitting? Is that in build? Is that in sign-off? So anybody will be able to go to look at that. And how I see the robust nature of the Statewide Broadband Advisory Board, and because it represents so 14, I think, different disciplines, that feedback of, you know, what are you hearing from the schools that have community anchor institutions in Igigik? Where are we with that build? Feedback on where we are and how we're doing managing the implementation phase of the program.
Thank you.
Thank you. And final question today, Vice Chair Story.
Thank
Thank you, Chair Carrick. And through the chair, thank you for your guidance and your work on all that you have been doing these last few years. I think we're all appreciative. Chair Carrick had asked you if you wanted to respond to some of the recommendations that we've had. And right now, we don't have a lot of time, but I would be interested in your recommendations as we go forward, particularly about maintenance and operations and how we're going to, you know, keep things going after, you know, the bead is helping us build. I hear it's for infrastructure. So I would really like to hear your opinion about that and on the recommendations. I think it would be helpful to us. We really wanted to have this meeting today to just assess where we were and any things that we needed to be aware of and how to possibly move forward, because you know, this is such an opportunity, as you said, and we're making such good progress on it. And it's so good to know the challenges we have. And when I think about our school districts and how much they pay for their internet services and they get a lot of subsidies, it would just be helpful to have a better picture of how we see that in the long term.
And you do not have to have a full answer to that.
Because I don't.
I'm not expecting it through the chair. I'm not expecting it. That's why I said certainly. I mean, this is a conversation that was so important today and to continue. And we all want to solve. We all want to have local hire as we can and maintenance and affordability, all those things that is the goal. So I appreciate your any thoughts that you have in the future, and I think the whole committee does.
I guess the final thought, and I can get you a broader answer. The final thought that I can offer is that the NTIA has had a significant change in its focus from when the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act was signed to today. And the state of Alaska and the broadband office has been reacting to those changes to make sure that we, as best we can, and we're not perfect, get the best broadband under the BEAD program to Alaskans. And so that they... Mr. Williams, right, brings up a lot of points that when you run them through the filter of the BEAD restructuring program on June 6th, when you run them through that restructure, you get a different lens of what we had to do. And when you run them through the BAFO that we had to do that we were originally given on a Friday, 72 hours to do, and asked for 2 weeks and got a week and a half, right? There's challenges that we faced in order to try and be the best partner we can with the NTIA, as well as make sure that we get the best broadband we can to Alaskans. And I think we've done that through the awards that we've made.
Thank you, Director Lochner. I think that's a great spot to wrap it up for today. And I would just encourage you and any of our presenters today, if you'd like to provide any additional comments, written follow-up, response to other testifiers, anything of that nature as a document to our House State Affairs Committee, we'll happily distribute those follow-ups to members. And otherwise, just want to thank everybody for presenting today. Mr. Williams with Pacific Dataport, Mr. Glover with Tanana Chiefs Conference, Mr. Wayland at GCI, Ms. Kavanaugh from ACS, and Director Lochner with the Broadband Office. This concludes our business for today. Our next meeting is this Saturday at 3:15 p.m. And at that meeting, our agenda is as follows. We are hearing two of three all different I'll just note for members, bills relating to daylight savings time. At our Saturday hearing, we'll hear SB 26 from Senator Merrick's office. And we'll also hear House Bill 229 from Representative Holland's office. And we will schedule the third bill on this subject for next week. So with nothing else on our agenda today, we are adjourned at 5:15 p.m.